KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and beginning in this coming academic year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm really excited and honored to have on Professor Frederick Schauer, who is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law, former acting dean at the Kennedy School at Harvard. I met Fred at a conference a few months ago at Duke on the philosophy of information, where he gave a truly outstanding 40-minute, I might add, talk on the right to know. Really asking questions and what questions should be asked, as opposed to answering those questions. And being someone that has been interested in this issue and hearsay culture being focused on this issue for the last several years, I was taking copious notes, and Fred graciously agreed to come on the show to expand on that discussion and also talk about a forthcoming article in the Yale Journal on Regulation that also focuses on these questions of transparency and how we define them. This is an issue that for Hearsay Culture listeners, you know quite well, because these questions of access to information and what information should and should not come out of government and how the public should react to it has become front and center as policymakers, both at the national and international level, grapple with questions involving intellectual property law and technology and how we deal with those issues. Our focus today with Fred is not going to be on the substance of those laws, but rather these very fundamental procedural questions of when that information should be made public, how, what kind of questions we should be asking, and how these rather amorphous concepts like transparency and secrecy and the right to privacy and so forth interact. With previous guests that we've had on the show, including Woody Hartzog and Dan Soliv and others, we have explored this amorphous concept of the right to privacy. It's one that's not very well defined. It's one that, of course, has burgeoned a growing and very active and vibrant community of privacy scholars. And yet, we don't really quite know what it means. When we take privacy and we overlay questions of access to information, is it fair to say that access to information or transparency is the opposite of privacy? Or is it something else? When we think about secrecy, what does that mean and how does it work? And as we're going to focus on today, what exactly do we mean when we say there is a right to know? What is the nature of that right? From where does it derive? And what is it exactly that we need to know in order to figure it out? So these very seemingly theoretical and abstract questions are actually quite practically important right now. We're recording this show, in fact, on July 10th, where we have these significant questions happening today, for example, in Ottawa, where this is TPP, it's the 20th round or so, of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is being negotiated largely in secret by the United States and 12 other countries, and yet it is unclear what exactly is being negotiated, or more specifically, what negotiating texts are out there. Again, emphasizing that we are not going to be focusing on the substance of those issues, this question of the right to know has become front and center for anyone who cares about the substance of the law. So, we are going to delve into Fred's thinking and writing on these issues today on Hearsay Culture. For those who aren't familiar, Fred, as I mentioned, is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. He is also Frank Stanton Professor of the First Amendment Emeritus at the Kennedy School of Government, where he taught from 1990 to 2008 and where he served as academic dean and acting dean, and also taught classes on evidence and freedom of speech at Harvard Law School. He's previously been associated with a number of terrific universities throughout the United States. I could spend the next 10 minutes reading off his publication. Suffice to say that he has written extensively. Among his publications that would be relevant to our discussion would be The Law of Obscenity in 1976, Free Speech, A Philosophical Inquiry, going right through Profiles, Probabilities, and Stereotypes, a book that Harvard University Press published in 2003. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and former holder of a Guggenheim Fellowship. He is joining us from his office via Skype at the University of Virginia. So I'm going to end that introduction, Fred, because as I mentioned, this could take several more minutes and I won't embarrass you too much. I'll simply say thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
I'm delighted to do it.
So, Fred, let's start off right here. I mentioned briefly your CV. I'm not going to ask for more of that, except to ask you how you became interested or why you became interested in this question of the right to know.
So, for me, it comes out of earlier and long-standing interests in and writing about free speech, free press, and the First Amendment. That's an area that I have worked on and have been thinking about since I was in practice in the early 1970s. Once one moves from core free speech questions to free press questions, one begins to see the ubiquity with which journalists talk about the right to know, free speech and free press arguments justified in terms of the right to know. And from the right to know, we move into questions put more recently in terms of transparency. But all of this comes together with the idea that free speech, free press, transparency, the right to know, and all of this is basically about a claim that information ought to be, in some important way, public.
So, Fred, you have an article that you shared with me that's forthcoming in the Yale Journal on Regulation on this question, and I'm going to quote you back to you and just kind of ask you a question off of it. You've written in this article, which I believe is still in draft form, so I won't hold you to the exact text. Perhaps you'll change it, but let me read this quote. So you wrote, "Transparency is a tool of accountability. We desire transparency, it is said, in order that decision makers will be more accountable to the public, to the press, and to other decision makers. But to be accountable to another institution, including the public, is to be more subject to control by that institution and thus less independent from that institution. In many contexts, therefore, we buy accountability through transparency at the price of independence." Now, I could literally say to you, Fred, please comment, and I could go get a sandwich and leave, and, you know, this could take the rest of the talk. So let's break this down a little bit. There's a lot of, and we're going to talk about it, there are a number of phrases and words there that we want to define more carefully, but let me start at this top level. As you think about particularly this last point, that we buy accountability through a transparency at the price of independence, before we get into the theory and your thoughts on it, I want to ask you a practical question. Do you think, as we're recording today on July 8th, 2014, that policymakers in particular think of transparency in that way?
Probably not, but then again, that may depend on which policymakers we are talking about. So if we are talking about, to be current once again, if we are talking about the policy members who sit on House and Senate committees, and if we are talking about those policymakers when they are trying to get information from the Internal Revenue Service that may or may not exist or may or may not at some point ever have existed, their view is that they want to hold the Internal Revenue Service accountable. And therefore, they are making a claim for transparency. They are claiming that the Internal Revenue Service ought to be disclosing information in order that the IRS be accountable to Congress. Conversely, when in various other contexts, particularly the national security ones, various national security agencies or officials or whatever think it very important to keep information secret, what they are in effect saying is, we are accountable in a certain way, but we do not want to be accountable to everyone who will get this information. We do not want to be accountable to foreign governments. We do not want to be accountable to terrorists. Sometimes we don't even want to be accountable to a critical press.
So when we think about these ideas, and I'm going to start at this very top level again, before we get into a more detailed discussion, these words that we use and are bandied around are not well defined, as you know. And so
they're basically not defined at all.
Or not defined at all. There we go.
They are weapons in rhetorical and political debates, or they are weapons in public and at times judicial claims.
And so in light of what you just said, before we even define those things, perhaps I'll ask you this question, because you did allude to this in your talk at Duke. So you offered several examples of where these issues come up without definition. And before I ask about your definitions, perhaps you could share some of those examples that you think illustrate the problem that we're going to be talking about today.
Sure. One of the article that you mentioned was written in the context of a conference at Yale on financial transparency or financial regulation in general, and I was on a panel dealing with financial transparency. That issue came up in the context a few years ago of the TARP program, more commonly referred to as the bank bailout. But one of the issues there was, to what extent should the banks that received federal funds be transparent about their uses of those funds? The banks made some information available, but not that much. Some number of regulators claimed plausibly, this is government money. The taxpayers have a right to know how it is being used. The banks claimed also plausibly that a lot of this money was being given to consumers in order to buy homes. A lot of it was loaned, well, not given, loaned. A lot of it was loaned to small businesses, and that we have obligations of confidentiality to our borrowers, whether they be small businesses, whether they be homeowners or whatever. So it's not entirely clear. The bank said that we should be transparent at that level of detail. That was one of the debates. Similarly, there is, of course, the transparency debate going on right now with respect to Edward Snowden. One of the interesting sidebars of that, and I talked about this a little bit at Duke, is that Glenn Greenwald, the relevant journalist in this, did an interview a couple of weeks ago in the context of his forthcoming book. One of the things that I think it's now, it's no longer forthcoming, it has come forth. One of the things he said was that this book contains quite a bit of information not previously disclosed that Edward Snowden was able to obtain. And then Greenwald said, and the book also contains a lot of other information that I'm not going to tell you about that will be in the next book. There is, of course, the irony of Greenwald claiming, on the one hand, that the public has a right to know what Edward Snowden discovered, Edward Snowden claiming that there is a right to know the government's information that he discovered or disclosed or leaked, depending on what word you want to use, and at the same time saying, but I'm not going to give you a bunch of information that I have precisely because I want to keep it secret in order to use it in my next book.
That is ironic. Is there? Do you think, incidentally, that there's a principled defense of such an action, or do you think would you think it's more fairly described as the honest effort to make as much of a splash by putting data out right incrementally as possible?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
Obviously, there is the maybe principled, maybe strategic, to maximize the amount of splash. There is the issue, maybe principled, maybe strategic, of claiming what are in effect property or property-like rights in information. We see it. It's your field more than mine, but it's what in the whole intellectual property area people are claiming all the time. This is our property. We don't have to disclose it. That's, again, partly principled, partly strategic. There's also the somewhat more principled defense of all of this, again, relating to issues of property, that I unearthed this information. Let's call it a hypothetical I here, not Greenwald or Snowden or anyone else. Someone who says, I unearthed this information, I produced it, I located it, I did all of the work, therefore I get to decide who gets it, how they get it, and when they get it. It's a property notion. Indeed, it's a property notion that goes back to ideas from John Locke. People who develop the property, people who invest in the property, have some kind of rights by virtue of the efforts and investment that they have put in. There are arguments the other way, but that's at least a principled argument, and there are principled arguments against it.
Which we will talk about as well. We're chatting with Fred Schauer of the University of Virginia School of Law and KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. All right, Fred, so now I'm gonna ask for your definitions. The words and phrases that are not defined at all, as you've indicated, and now I'm gonna ask you to define them or at least offer a definition. So let's start with that top level word, transparency. You've offered a definition in your Yale article. You can certainly talk about that or another one, but how would you define transparency for present day purposes?
So I think I would define transparency in a somewhat more specific way than it tends to be defined, and I would just say transparency is the availability of some information to someone else. And if we put it that way, it's not entirely clear that it's a good thing. It's not entirely clear that it's a bad thing. It is very context dependent. It is very relative to both the possessor of the information and the person who wants it. When we put it that way, we can at least connect with the idea that in many contexts, transparency is not necessarily a good thing. After all, I do not have a transparent bathroom door. I suspect that you don't have one either. Very few people, except for the ones who live in Philip Johnson's glass house in New Canaan, Connecticut, have transparent walls on their houses. So transparency for me is something close to the basic physical notion, that is, there is some information that somebody has that somebody else doesn't. And transparency is the idea of getting some information that someone else has.
Now, as you think about it, you said earlier that the word isn't defined. Do you think that there are any... Is there a range of definitions that you've come across? And perhaps my question really is, if you were thinking about the poles of transparency, how would you define those?
So I think if we were thinking about the poles, as you suggested in your introduction, at one pole of, let us call it, non-transparency, we don't use the word non-transparency. We use words like secrecy. We use words like privacy, but the idea is the extreme of non-transparency. At the other extreme, which we don't see very much in the world, we see the extreme transparency of some information available to everyone and anyone who wants it. And I say we don't see this very often. As with the Greenwald-Snowden example I used earlier, claims about transparency and claims about the right to know are very often made by people who don't want transparency about their knowledge. So after all, we see the idea of the right to know being trumpeted most prominently and often wisely by mainstream journalists. But I cannot walk into the offices of the Washington Post and the New York Times and say, I want to see what you now have. Mm-hmm. They're going to say, no, you can't. We'll decide what and when we are going to publish it. The irony is even greater because in many contexts, including national security contexts, the press itself, which often claims the right to know, which often claims that there should be governmental transparency, claims under the rubric of journalists' privilege that government has no right to the information that certain journalists may have, because journalists have in turn promised secrecy, non-transparency to their sources.
Mm-hmm. There, and it leads to, and it, you know, again at this definitional stage with those polls, the focus of your talk at Duke and our main focus today, which is this concept of the right to know. Now that's something we're going to push on heavily for the remainder of the interview, but let's talk at a top level, and maybe I'll ask the question this way. Is there a definition of the right to know, given that we're dealing with a bundle of ideas in that concept? Can you or would you offer a definition of the right to know at a top level, or is that not possible?
I think by and large, it would probably not be a good idea to offer a particular definition as such of the right to know, but one way to start is that at times when we talk about rights, we are talking about specific positive legal rights. So one understanding of the right to know might be the kind of right to know embodied in the Freedom of Information Act, or the equivalent at various state levels, or the right to know that's embodied in state and federal so-called sunshine laws. That is, here the right to know is a specific statutory right to a very wide range of governmentally recorded information. That's what the Freedom of Information Act is all about. There are exceptions, but that's the idea. And we might say that in that context, yes, there is a right to know, and whether there should or should not be is a policy question involving philosophical, policy, economic, and related kinds of considerations. If we take that one level higher to the constitutional level, reporters and the press have been claiming since at least the early 1970s that there is a right to know as a matter of federal constitutional law. That is, that there is a First Amendment right to know, the Freedom of Information Act apart, other specific statutes apart, that the First Amendment grants either to people in general or to the press in its capacity as the press, a right to access to government information, a right to access to government meetings, a right to access to government facilities. Over and over again, the Supreme Court, regardless of its political or ideological posture at the time, has rejected such claims. And therefore, with the narrow exception of the public's right to attend trials, as a matter of federal constitutional law at the moment, there is no First Amendment right to know. There is certainly a First Amendment right to disclose what you have obtained, again, with exceptions, qualifications, and so on. But when we think, for example, about whether it be Snowden now, or WikiLeaks a few years ago, or Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers back in the early 1970s, there is a huge difference between the First Amendment rights of the New York Times and the Washington Post to publish what Daniel Ellsberg had given them. Mm-hmm. And the absence of an existing positive First Amendment right of Daniel Ellsberg to get it, or even the New York Times or the Washington Post to get it.
So we've got so many moving parts here. It's Hearsay Culture listeners know this, and I'll just say right now, right, we can only, even in the hour we have, touch the tip of the iceberg here, because now I'm going to come back to the right to know, but ask about one more of these rights that I mentioned in the introduction that also somewhat defy definition, which is the right to privacy. Before yep. I ask about that interaction, again, these are the tough questions, Fred, but I'm giving you time to answer them, so take the time you need. How would you define the right to privacy today?
Again, like lots of rights and like lots of words, it may be best thought of as an umbrella word that encompasses a number of different, quite discrete rights that we ought to keep separate. So when we talk about a right to privacy, we might be talking, in our most immediate context, about a right to keep personal information personal. When people argue for a right to privacy, they say that information about themselves ought not to be available to others, ought not to be available to the government, ought not to be available to the press, and so on. A right to the possession of and control of information about my person. That's very different from what we might think, let's call that informational privacy. We might distinguish that from physical privacy. When my neighbor aims his or her targeted microphone or telephoto lens through my window, or maybe even physically comes in the front door if it's unlocked and looks around, my physical privacy has been invaded. Indeed, the Fourth Amendment, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures, is largely a protection of the physical privacy of one's home, at times one's person, one's possessions, and so on. And informational privacy and physical privacy might in turn be distinguished from decisional privacy, most commonly associated these days with issues about abortion, various other lifestyle kinds of questions. To what extent is my ability to make certain kinds of decisions without governmental interference a dimension of my decisional autonomy that these days, although perhaps least accurately in terms of ordinary language, goes by the name of privacy?
We're chatting with Fred Schauer of the University of Virginia School of Law and KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU-FM Stanford, which is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station. So Fred, now that we've dealt with these broad questions of definitions, let's drill down a little bit. You know, the issues surrounding the near economic, at least financial system collapse that we've all been living through over the last several years, and then our slow dig out of it, had heavy questions, as you mentioned earlier, of access to information. And in fact, you know, everything from the collateral that was used by the Fed's windows when they made these loans, which were considered to be commercial secrets, on down created questions that news entities like Bloomberg and others attempted to get access to through FOIA and through non-formal methods like leaks and so forth. When we think about this access question, I'm curious to ask you this. We've seen over, not just with the TARP programs, but also, you know, daily, it seems, the Snowden's leaks, WikiLeaks through Julian Assange posting information on the web and so forth. How does one fit the reality of leaks into these very difficult questions of access to information? Is the leak an extrajudicial, some kind of anarchic way to get information? Should it be something that is factored into our definitions? In other words, because a leak, of course, is perhaps nothing more than simply, as others have written, right? Edward Snowden didn't like that something was happening inside government, and he decided that this was something that the public should know without regard to anything else, right? That's certainly a position on Snowden. So where do you fit leaks into these questions of privacy, of the right to know, of transparency, and so forth?
So it's an interesting and important topic. One of the things that makes it interesting is that certain kinds of leaks are, we might say, I'm not sure that unintentional is the right word, but at least at some level, certain kinds of leaks, of which Daniel Ellsberg's and Edward Snowden's are prime examples, certain kinds of leaks are plainly unwanted by the people who are in charge of certain agencies or operations or whatever. Other kinds of leaks are somewhat close to intentional. Indeed, sometimes they're called plants rather than leaks. And very often officials will leak things intentionally. We call them leaks, or they call them leaks, because maybe they don't want their names associated with them. Maybe they are trial balloons. So it's not entirely clear that all leaks are unwanted. It's not entirely clear that all leaks are actually leaks in the sense that we think of the Ellsberg and Snowden leaks as leaks. But certainly, if we take those as the classic leaks, that is, an employee who has access to information but no official or formal authority to disclose that information to others, nevertheless does so, whether it be to the press or to the public or whatever. Sometimes they do it out of personal grievance. Sometimes they do it out of principle. But one of the things that characterizes the classic central leak rather than something that's closer to a plant is that the leaker typically doesn't have the authority to leak, and the leak is plainly unwanted by those higher in the so-called chain of command. One of the things that makes this problem much more salient now than even than it was even at the time of Ellsberg, of course, is that modern technology, the internet, and much else has the ability to magnify the consequences of a leak much more than it would have been at the time. After all, one of the things that made Ellsberg's leak or disclosure, or from another point of view, theft, right, consequential, was the fact that the Washington Post and the New York Times were willing to publish it. Suppose that Ellsberg instead had unauthorizedly taken the Pentagon papers, gone to the New York Times, gone to other newspapers, and all of them had said, we are not interested, we are not going to publish this. It's not entirely clear what options would have been open to Ellsberg in 1971. It is very clear what options are open to someone in that position in 2014, through the miracle of the internet, the miracle of blogs, the miracle of a whole bunch of other things. The leaker is not nearly as dependent upon a somewhat more controlled mass media than as would have been the case in 1971.
Yeah, and you alluded right there, Fred, to what my follow-up question was going to be, right? To the extent that Ellsberg was operating through a more centralized system and with fewer outlets, right, where the public right. could get access to information, right, those distinctions are largely gone today. However, and over my pushback question is this, right? To the extent that people are reading blogs, right, that is still not the same as a New York Times article, right, or The Guardian even, what have you. So while there are definitely more ways for information to be made public, do you think that it's also true that there is the same impact or the ability to have an impact today through media and leaks? In other words, while there it's easier to get the information out there, the dispersion of information once it's out there might make it less powerful. So it's really a question rather than a statement. What's your reaction?
I think you're entirely right. Back when I was practicing law, and this information may be a little bit out of date, but I think it is not. When pretrial discovery takes place in civil cases, one way in which a party in possession of a great deal of information can stonewall is to give the other party nothing. The other way they can stonewall is to give the other party everything. That is, they can say, you want information about our past transactions? Let us take you to four rooms full of four filing cabinets. Help yourself.
Right.
Under certain circumstances, the dilution effect of too much information turns into almost no information. And I think much the same happens now. In effect, the sorters become more important. Authority becomes more important. There is a reason why at times those who have, let us call it, privileged access want to keep the privileged access. Indeed, a recent good example of this is that press credentials to Supreme Court arguments are largely controlled by a committee of journalists. That committee of journalists has just denied credentials to the SCOTUS blog, if I at least understand this right, based on just reading news reports, based on the fact that those who are in charge of the SCOTUS blog are themselves advocates before the court on frequent occasion rather than just journalists. I don't have anything important to say about who's right or who's wrong in this controversy, but it is clear that not everybody can fit inside the Supreme Court. There has to be some form of privileged access. Who's going to get it and who's not is an enormously important issue. Similarly, when we go from the Supreme Court to armed combat rather than verbal combat, there are a limited number of people who can actually be in a submarine or be on the front line of battle. So when the military decides who is going to be part of a press pool, when the military decides who is going to be granted privilege access to the front lines of a battle or the front lines of a military operation, they are basically saying some sources of access are more important than others. It remains the case that the so-called mainstream media are mainstream for a reason. Whether that's a good or a bad thing is something that can be debated. We might say that rather than allow the journalists from the mainstream newspapers, the mainstream news magazines, and the mainstream television networks privileged access, what the military ought to do is invite applications from the public at large, maybe screen everybody for security, but having done that, then conduct a lottery. That's not going to happen in our lifetime, and one of the reasons it's not going to happen in our lifetime is that the mainstream media likes its mainstreamness.
We're chatting with Fred Schauer of the University of Virginia on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Fred, we're getting near what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking you questions, particularly in this case, where you don't have the time that you feel you need to answer the question adequately, and yet, like any good journalist, I ask the question anyway.
Sure.
So I'm going to keep going. You alluded to this, and thank you for making this interview exceptionally easy for me, because you're seeding my next questions. You mentioned this concept of privileged access, right? And that privilege is because as much as we think we know the benefits of transparency, and that's been, I think those benefits have been argued extensively, the drawbacks of transparency, perhaps at least right now in areas that I've mentioned, like IP policy and technological policy and elsewhere, oftentimes are marginalized. In your Duke talk, you talked about the right to know as being a right against other interests. And that idea of privileged access, I think, ties together. So if you would, and I said we'd come back to it, and now we will, what are those other interests, or to put it differently, what are the arguments against transparency as you've defined it, against the right to know? And I'll put aside the right to privacy for a moment, because that one might cut either way.
Okay, so even if we put aside privacy, one of the arguments, and one of the strongest arguments, we see it at times made by government, we see it at times made by large corporations, we see it at times made by various other organizations, is that very often it is hard to make tough decisions under circumstances of total transparency. Whether it be the Supreme Court's deliberations or faculty meetings about hiring or promotion or tenure, or cabinet meetings on issues of national security, one of the things we know is that at times, if things are too public, all of the participants are posturing, and it's difficult to get alternative arguments on the table. It is very difficult to put out tentative arguments just to get some discussion about the issue. So very often, an argument against transparency is an argument for decision-making rigor, where at least one dimension of decision-making rigor is the ability to get every argument out on the table, the ability of people to play the devil's advocate, as it were, if necessary. All of this is somewhat more difficult under circumstances of transparency. And that very often when we see governmental decisions made under circumstances of transparency, what we see is lots of officials who are publicly posturing, and the actual decisions are made either in the halls or are made worse.
So in light of that practical reality, Fred, you know, it comes back to the question of what kind of transparency and what the parameters of transparency will be. And I'm not going to ask you those questions today, because obviously that's at least, well, that's another several hours. Instead, I'd rather focus on the questions that we need to ask. And so I'll ask it this way. You know, transparency and the right to know, and now I'll include the right to privacy, of course, operate in the broader context of the particular subject matter or issues that are being discussed. And so some issues and policy questions are more controversial than others. Some have broader and more diverse and deeper interests that are being pitted against each other than others. Do you think that there is a basis, or should we be thinking about these issues of right to know and transparency and right to privacy on a subject matter basis? And I ask that almost as a constitutional matter, as I do of anything else. What's your take on what is it, and by the way, to add further context to it, what's increasingly becoming an interest, at least in the IP field, which is to tailor IP laws around specific industries, with the recognition being that different industries require a different package of incentives. But putting aside IP, what do you think about these other concepts as being tailored by industry?
I think it's to some extent necessary, and even if not necessary, often desirable. Obviously, there are decisions about to be made about how coarse-grained or fine-grained these distinctions ought to be, but even in governmental context, we might want to think about the kinds of decisions that are being made and who's making the decisions. One way of thinking about transparency in terms of governmental decision making is that transparency is in fact a vehicle of democracy, where democracy here I define simply as majoritarianism, or simply as some degree of popular control. So if we there are long-standing debates about what kinds of governmental decisions ought to be made by more or less democratic procedures. Those track on to more or less transparency. So there are some very, very technical scientific questions that the Environmental Protection Agency deals with. There are some very technical financial questions that the Federal Reserve deals with. And in fact, there have been long-standing debates under the rubric of transparency about the extent to which the Federal Reserve's deliberations should or should not be public. After all, whenever a member of the Federal Reserve breathes or sneezes or does anything else, the stock market reacts. So there are serious questions about the extent to which these decisions should, even in a democratic society, be subject to, let us call it, immediate democratic control. Very few people would argue that every single governmental decision ought to be made by referendum or ought to be made by the referendum equivalent of immediate transparency.
So, Fred, let me follow up here with what I think is a more practical question, but an important one. And it's one of, for lack of a better phrase, judicial capacity. All right, we as scholars and people that write about policy will often make proposals that say, in order for the court or for policymakers to decide this issue, here's 9 factors that should be weighed. And, of course, the pushback almost invariably, almost regardless of the topic or the list, is the courts are incapable or will not handle that list well and will get bad decisions and so forth. And so my question is a rather difficult one and somewhat sensitive, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Like I said, this is the unfair portion of the show. What's your take on the judiciary's capacity? And I don't mean that in terms of intelligence, of course. I mean it in terms of the practical realities of having large case dockets and so forth and expertise and what have you, to do a nuanced analysis of these questions. Oftentimes, particularly on the governmental side, as you know, transparency and the right to know becomes rather unitary, right? We take an exception to FOIA, we say that's that, this is it, done, no access, and so forth. But to have that more granular analysis of these questions would require a capacity that may or may not exist inside the judiciary, because of course we know if these issues are going to be figured out, they're going to be figured out probably at that level. So what's your take on the courts or judiciary's capacity, as I've defined it, to handle these issues today?
So with respect to questions like this, I always like to ask the follow-up question, mm-hmm. compared to what?
Right.
that is, I think you're absolutely right that making fine-grained determinations about transparency, which is of course what courts do in interpreting some of the vague language of the Freedom of Information Act, involves the courts in areas in which they may not have the time or they may not have the specialized expertise. On the other hand, if the default, or if the what that the compared to what is compared to, is a determination by an agency with more expertise, but also more interest in keeping its own processes secret, what we are really trading off is more expertise, but more of an interest in the outcome, compared to less expertise, but also less of an interest in the outcome. That is less ideological, less self-interest, less personal interest, less institutional interest. So one of the things we do when we entrust lots of issues to the courts is to, in effect, say, we realize that you don't know a whole lot about environmental science or national security, or the ins and outs of financial regulation or a whole bunch of other things. But one of your advantages is that you don't really care. You are genuinely disinterested. And at times that disinterest more than compensates for lack of expertise. At times it doesn't.
Do you think, therefore, that question of then who is an important one? Do you think, as a practical matter, that we are more likely to find that we get to better results by using the courts versus by using a regulatory entity? In other words, the places where such decisions could be made prior to getting to the courts and litigation could be inside a regulatory entity that is given that same list of 8 or 9 factors, and I'm of course making that up, right? And say, oh, you apply these rules. So, I don't mean this to be a crystal ball question or a predictive question. I mean, really based upon evidence and your thinking, what's your take on where the locus is more likely to lead to the best results?
I think the more technical it is, the more likely we are to get better results from a specialized body or a specialized agency or whatever. One of the problems with courts is that courts are systematically disabled from getting the kind of information that agencies and other governmental institutions typically get. That is, and here I'll engage in a moment of self-promotion. What I'm about to say will be explained at some greater length in an article coming out in Daedalus within the next few weeks, I believe. But courts are very odd institutions in terms of getting information, especially appellate courts. They are at the mercy of the parties. Courts cannot just go out and say, we need more information, so let's go out and get it. They are largely at the mercy of a moderately standard set of legal sources. Some judges and justices are beginning to press against this, but it's a somewhat more constrained informational environment. In numerous other ways, courts are far more informationally disabled than other kinds of institutions. At times, they're so informationally disabled that we might be better off placing more trust in other kinds of institutions. Interestingly, at least to me, among justices of the Supreme Court, Justice Breyer has been the one who has most insistently recognized this, not so much in Supreme Court opinions, although occasionally there as well, but in extrajudicial writings and speeches, has worried about the increasing inability of courts to get the kinds of information they need in order to make increasingly complex questions. And he's offered some number of interesting suggestions to overcome some of these disabilities, but at times we have to recognize that courts are far more informationally constrained, constricted than agencies and at times even legislatures.
So, Fred, as we're chatting with Fred Schauer, the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law, again, you've made this so easy for me, and I want to invite you back on the show simply because
sure.
These are easy interviews, but, of course, all kidding aside, this substance is wonderful, and you are invited back. You just alluded to it, which is my last question. Given the work you do, you mentioned this article coming out of Daedalus. What else are you working on right now?
So, my academic life has a bunch of different dimensions, some of which are entirely unrelated to each other. I continue to work on the question I was just talking about. One of the things that I teach and write about is the law of evidence, in addition to teaching and writing about free speech, free press kinds of questions. So when I think about evidence law, I think about how courts get the kind of information they want to get, and I continue to work in this area. I also, in terms of free speech kinds of questions, I've become very interested and have started doing some writing about a phenomenon that I have labeled in the past, and I continue to label free speech opportunism. That is, under what circumstances do free speech arguments arise, not because there's something at the very core of the idea of free speech or free press that makes them logically good arguments, but because they are perceived as strategically advisable because of the public and largely positive salience, positive valence of free speech, free press arguments. In your field, even more than mine, we see this a great deal recently in terms of people making free speech arguments about commercial regulation, free speech arguments about source code, free speech arguments about various other issues that are technically about information, but they are far removed from questions that have traditionally been free speech questions. Opportunism is the phenomenon by which good lawyers, doing what good lawyers are supposed to do, seize on what looks like a good argument, even though it might not be an argument most naturally related to the issue at hand. And finally, I have another abstract legal theory side of my life. I have a book coming out in a few months with the Harvard University Press called The Force of Law. I'm interested in the coercive dimensions of law. Very often, especially in the circles in which you and I travel, legal academics are fond of thinking about law in its most glorious, romantic, positive tones. There are important parts of law that are just about telling people what to do and making them do it even if they don't want to do so. I'm trying to theorize the most obvious coercive side of law, and that's what I do in this book.
Fred, you're invited back repeated times. In fact, maybe I'll just do a whole quarter of shows involving your work and just be done with it, and we could just have a, you know, 10-chapter discussion. Fred Schauer, David and Mary Harrison, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Say Culture, for sharing your time and your insights with my listeners. I do invite you back, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
It's been a delight and a privilege. Thank you.
So I'm excited to mention the remaining guests coming up on Hearsay Culture's schedule. Again, we're recording the show on July 8th for airing in August. That's primarily because I'm going to be heading to the infamous former Vice President Cheney undisclosed location, which is actually in Idaho where my in-laws live, where I will be focusing on my own writing, and so I'm recording some of these shows in advance. But coming up next week will be Nabiha Syed of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz. Again, unbelievable. Seated by Fred's last answer, who's going to be focusing on drone technology and freedom of information and the press. Following that, the Professor Dave Columbia of the Virginia Commonwealth University, author of the terrific book, The Cultural Logic of Computation. And rounding out this quarter on Hearsay Culture, member of European Parliament Mariette Shaki on democracy and technology in Europe. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. This quarter, you can listen to Hearsay Culture on KZSU Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific time by streaming at kzsulive.stanford.edu or by getting a podcast by going to hearsayculture.com or by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, or lastly, by going to the webpage for Stanford CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I thank you for listening today. Again, email me if you'd like with any comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.